Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. So this is the second of the two lectures on music. Last time I distinguished three ways in which mental states could be involved in the appreciation of music. And two of them involved what you actually hear in the music. One of them was the agentially expressive. The other was the purely expressive. And I tried to give substantive accounts of each of those. In the case of the agentially expressive, I said you perceived certain features of the music as similar to expressive actions by human beings. And in the other case, I said that when you heard something in the purely expressive case, you heard certain features of the music metaphorically as certain kinds of emotions as experienced from the inside, or certain kinds of action modalities, doing something with determination, overcoming difficulty, doing something with weakness. And the third kind was the emotional reaction you might have to a piece of music. And I tried to say something about the way in which the emotions or mental states are given when you hear those mental states in the music. I said that they were given in what I called Jacksonian ways, in honor of the Australian philosopher Frank Jackson. These are ways of being given mental states that involve an acquaintance relation to a certain type of state. And I emphasized that the emotions and the action modalities that you hear in the music are fine-grained in a certain way. They're highly specific, and that comports with what various people have said over the years about music, comports with what Mendelssohn says. It explains what I call the principle of acquaintance in music. It explains why music can add so much to a given text, and so on and so forth. What I didn't talk about last time was the role of agency in the perception of music, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I think that agency plays a far greater role in the phenomenology and the very nature of music than has been fully articulated hitherto. I should say that the musicological literature, in my view, in the last 10 years has become much more interesting and sensitive to this. I think that agency, with its necessary involvement of an agent, plays a role in what makes something music, and it plays a role in some of the layers of content distinctive of the perception of music. And I think the various roles of agency interact with one another in producing the rich perceptual states that are involved in hearing the music. So in this talk, I'm going to characterize some of these roles, their relations, and their capacity to explain some otherwise puzzling phenomena about the perception of music. I think they also set an agenda for an interdisciplinary research project on music as well. I may mention that a bit towards the end. The most basic point is that we commonly perceive music as action. We commonly perceive a particular musical sound as an event produced by an agent, even if we don't actually perceive the agent who's producing the music. And there's very likely an empirical evolutionary explanation of this fact, this psychological fact. It's extremely rare for a sound that's a musical note with a discernible pitch to occur in the environment unless it is in fact produced by an agent. The vast majority of natural sounds not produced by an agent, the rustlings, streams splashing over stones, rain, rocks falling, creakings, bumps, wind in the trees, they're sound events in which there's no orderly repetition of frequencies. Now, ordinary musical pitches played by a musical instrument or when you're singing are, of course, not pure sine waves. They're not like the pure sine waves that are generated by banging a tuning fork, a really good tuning fork. But when a note is ordinarily played, there is an orderly repetition. There's an orderly repetition of the various multiple frequencies involved, and that's what generates pitch, and that's what is commonly perceived as an exercise of agency when we hear the music. And when you hear a sequence of notes, a sequence of pitches, as opposed to anything like a rustling or a banging or a thumping, we hear a sequence of pitches, of course, that involves a multiplication of low probabilities that it's produced by something that's not an agent. For a whole sequence of sounds to produce that actually pitches by something that's not an agent, it's an extremely improbable event. And obviously, it can be of great importance for an organism to distinguish between a sound that's produced by inanimate interactions between objects and processes and a sound that indicates the presence and perhaps the states and psychological attitudes of another agent. And it would be highly adaptive for organisms to be sensitive to that distinction between cases. One way for a subject to be sensitive is to perceive sounds that are pitches, to perceive them as actions. And in the vast majority of cases, that will be perceiving the sounds as they really are. That applies both to vocalizations and to sounds made by musical instruments. It's a very well-known phenomenon in psychology that if one feature is statistically well correlated with another already perceptible property in a creature's environment, that first feature will likely come to be incorporated into the creature's perception of the already perceptible property, if it's adaptive for that to be so. And the incorporation of agency into the perception of a heard sound that's a note is just a special case of that general phenomenon, I think. Here I want to advert to the excellent writings of Roberto Cassati and Jerome Dokich in their book on La Philosophie du Son and the American philosopher Casey O'Callaghan on sounds. These theories are not absolutely identical, but they coincide on one crucial central point, which is that a sound is an event. It's an event which either causes or involves a disturbance in a medium when a medium is present. If that's correct, and I'm sure it is correct, for a musical sound to be an action is simply then for the disturbing event in which it consists to be an action. And of course, a disturbing of a medium can be an action. Nothing metaphysically problematic about that. And as always, you have to distinguish the sound event itself from the way the sound event is heard. We commonly hear music as action, even when we know it's not so. We may know when we hear some played audio file that it is, say, a computer-generated simulation of an early Haydn string quartet, let's say. Knowledge that that's so doesn't destroy the impression that stringed instruments are being played by agents producing the music. In fact, that will be essential to it being good simulation. So these are very basic, simple points. What's the relevance of them for the philosophy, phenomenology, aesthetics of music? I think part of the answer is that they open the door, by way of the presence of agency in the very perception of music as music, to the possibility of musical phenomenology that exploits that agency in various ways in our perception of music. I think the intrinsic involvement of agency in the perception of music as such should make us very skeptical of the late Roger Scruton's view that the only relevant features of the occurrence of a musical event are what he calls the acousmatic features, that is, the features of pitch, volume, and timbre. And many of the points that I'll be making this afternoon will suggest counterexamples to that thesis. So here's a first collection of basic musical phenomenological features in which agency is involved. So in a piece with multiple instruments or voices, we hear certain notes as continuing a theme from some earlier notes, and not as similarly connected with other earlier notes. That's a phenomenon of temporal grouping, of one later particular temporal event with one rather than another of its temporal predecessors. It's analogous to the phenomenon of perceptual grouping in a spatial array, say as seeing the array as grouped in columns rather than in rows. Not only do we hear the music that way, we hear it as intentionally produced, as so grouped, provided the performer isn't making a mistake. The composer, as well as the performer, will normally have had such an intention. When a melody, for instance, is passed from one instrument to another, or from one voice to another, that's a case in which joint agency is heard in the performance. The musician to whom the melody is passed is, and is heard as, intentionally continuing the melody started by the others, and intending it to be heard as such a continuation. Hearing one note as continuing a theme or motif started by other sound events heard has sometimes received very exotic descriptions by philosophers. Such differing philosophers as Roger Scruton and Francis Wolff have written of virtual causality, and their thesis is that it seems that later notes are caused by earlier notes. It's even been said that the later notes in a theme or motif have an apparent inevitability given the earlier notes of the theme or motif. I think there's a genuine phenomenology behind these strong claims, but the phenomenon prompting these more exotic descriptions should be described in terms of agency, perceptual grouping, and the appreciation of the intentions of the performer. Suppose the listener has heard a certain sequence of notes as a theme or a motif, and heard it as intentional under a description that involves the music being heard under a certain grouping, grouped in a certain way rather than another. That's a distinctive element of phonology crucial to musical perception. But it doesn't mean that the later notes are caused by the earlier ones, nor does it mean that it seems that that's so. They are, and indeed seem to be, intentionally grouped with certain earlier notes. I would say that the later notes no more seem to be caused by the earlier ones than the later words in an uttered sentence seem to be caused by the earlier words. In that case, too, the later words are caused by the utterer's intention to utter that very sequence, and of course only that sequence of uttered words would fulfill that intention. Here's two contrasting, by contrast what I've just said, here's two passages from Roger Scruton writing about these matters. Here's passage one. Music makes use of a particular kind of sound, an acousmatic event which is heard apart from the everyday physical world and recognizes the instance of a type. He continues, this isolation of the pure sound event leads to a peculiar experience, which I've called the experience of tone. No longer does it seem as though the middle C that sounds is caused by someone blowing on the clarinet. Instead, Scruton continues, we hear it as a response to the B that preceded it, and as though calling in turn for the E that follows. Scruton goes on, when Brahms hands the second theme of the last movement of the second piano concerto in B-flat major, from orchestra to piano and back again, we hear a single melody jump electrically across these poles. Each note follows in sequence as though indifferent to the world of physical causes and responding only to its predecessor and to the force that inherits from the musical line. That's the first quote. Here's the second quote from Roger Scruton. We must be able to hear an order that contains no information about the physical world, which stands apart from the ordinary workings of cause and effect, and which is irreducible to any physical organization. At the same time, Scruton goes on, it contains a virtual causality of its own, which animates the elements that are joined by it. Even so, apparently simple a phenomenon as rhythm gives proof of this. That's the end of the two quotations from Roger Scruton. Scruton, I think, made all sorts of valuable contributions to the philosophy of music, but I actually find myself in disagreement with almost every sentence that I just quoted from him. I don't think we need any ontology of pure tone events that are somehow apart from the physical world, and which stand in supposed relations of virtual causality. What we need in the account of the perception of music is some explanatory description of the complex psychological properties and relations instantiated by these real musical sound events in the physical world. The perceived groupings that I've been describing are all groupings of physical events, particular token physical events. The relations in which it's intended they be heard, and in which in fact they are heard when all is working properly, they're all relations in which physical events, the sound themselves, can be heard as standing and do stand. So as I said, the physical events are themselves the sound events. And it's a thesis common both to Kossatsky and Dokic on sounds and to the theory of O'Callaghan that a sound is a physical event. On the Kossatsky-Dokic theory, the event may not cause a disturbance in a medium of transmission. And on O'Callaghan's theory, the event must be a disturbance in a medium to be a sound. So these theories differ, obviously, on such issues as whether there can be a sound in a vacuum. Anyway, for the sounds that are involved in the perception of music, and for present purposes, that difference between the theories does not matter. When there is perception of music, our topic, there is certainly a medium of transmission. The issue of whether the medium must exist for there to be a sound doesn't make much difference to the common commitment of these two theories, that there's a physical event which is the sound that's heard when the music is perceived. When the physical events that are perceived are also intentionally produced by agents and can be perceived as so produced, then we have the resources for generating a rich phenomenology. And of course, the same is true of the phenomenology of speech. There seems to me no pressure to postulate events other than physical events of utterance apart from the physical world in accounting for the phenomenology of speech. What's of interest is the rich set of properties and relations instantiated by the physical events that are speech utterances and our corresponding perception of those properties and relations. Here it's very important to recognize that there are multiple relations in which a spatial array of objects or a temporal sequence of complex events may stand, and that only some of these may be represented in perception. We perceive the spatial array, let's say, as grouped in columns rather than as grouped in rows. It's a mistake to ask whether the array is really arranged in columns rather than rows. It's obviously, in reality, arranged in both. The fact that it's a mistake to ask that question shouldn't at all be taken as a reason for thinking that the spatial perception of the array as grounded in columns isn't really about physical entities arranged in space. the perception obviously is about such physical entities and about their relations, and the same applies to sequences of sound events. We hear later notes in a piece with multiple parts or with harmony or in counterpoint as grouped with some rather than other of the earlier notes. It's physical events that we hear as so grouped. The continuations that we don't hear, the groupings we do not hear, are equally real. It's just they're not perceived and not intended to be perceived. These remarks can be generalized in their implications, and the approach suggests some further characterization of some extremely familiar distinctions. One such standard distinction is that between a theme and its accompaniment. The distinction involves agency and perception. The composer intends that the sequence of sounds that constitute the later parts of the theme be heard as continuations of the earlier notes of the theme, and to be perceptually grouped with them. The later notes of the accompaniment are not meant to be heard, nor are they generally heard, as continuations of the sequence of notes earlier in the accompaniment. And if they are so heard, and intended to be so heard, then we begin to have a case of a second theme or motif sounding simultaneously. It wouldn't be a simple case of accompaniment. Okay, now I want to introduce a modest theoretical notion that I think is extremely important in our enjoyment and appreciation of music. And they call it that of the expressed world perceived in hearing a musical world work. The express world perceived by a given listener on a particular occasion. And the expressed world perceived consists of, I've got five things here. Maybe this list is incomplete, be happy to be told it is. Consists of this. First of all, it consists of a definite fine-grained sequence of emotional states and action modalities heard in the work. A sequence of definite fine-grained states of emotional states, action modalities heard in the work with the relative durations as experienced in listening to the work. And second, it consists of a certain sequence of action types with their affect heard in the work in agentially expressive cases at the appropriate stage of the sequence I just mentioned in component one, with a specification of whether they're the actions of the subject experiencing the affect or actions of a different subject. Third, sometimes in hearing the music, one affective state or action modality is experienced as caused by another, or as growing out of it, or as gradually changing into another. And that too is part of the specification of the expressed world perceived. Or the change may be, if it's something that's the setting of a text, may be a response to some change in events. So a very famous, obvious case is the case in Mozart's Magic Flute. Tamino and Pamino are initially not allowed to speak to one another. Eventually that restriction is lifted and we begin to get a more hopeful this music. Sorry, it's terrible having to stop these examples. Anyway, we have a complete change of mood there. This is Mozart the dramatist. You hear in the orchestral accompaniment there, the gradually throbbing, increasing positive affect after these events. Sometimes you get in a passage of music a series of affective emotional states, and then it's clear that what you're meant to hear, and what you do in fact hear, is agency from the outside. You hear something drastic, something from the outside occurring. Get this to work. Let's see. So at the end of, this is the end of Mahler's Sixth Symphony. Thank you. So those were the hammer blows of fate. The listening subject at any given stage when listening to performance also has some obviously highly imperfect but obviously significant memory of what's gone before. Musically and emotionally and in the action modalities, that too should be included in the specification of the express world perceived as somebody's listening to a piece of music. And as I said, when you hear certain properties of the music metaphorically as a certain emotion, that's got the fine-grained Jacksonian specificity that we were talking about earlier. When there's an expressed world perceived in a piece of music, a kind of persona, an intentional subject, is already built into that conception. This persona or intentional subject is not something added by a further layer beyond perception, by some kind of postulation in thought, or by any other kind of mental action. As the music proceeds, a first-person affective history develops for this persona or intentional subject. This persona or intentional subject and its history supervenes on the rich perceptions produced by the music as it proceeds. And whenever a mental state is given under a mode of presentation involving an acquaintance relation, as I've been talking about, the states are also given as experienced by the subject of that state. That's why any expressed world heard in a piece of music also ipso facto involves an intentional subject. As a kind of supervening entity, intentional subjects of this kind are much, much closer to Dan Dennett's centers of narrative gravity, discussed in his chapter on subjects of experience in the Explaining Consciousness book, than, I think, are real subjects of experience. There are reasons in the metaphysics of subjects and experience for holding that real subjects of experience cannot be reduced to mental events and their relations, separate philosophical issue. And I've previously been very critical of Dan Dennett's account as a treatment of real subjects themselves. But Dennett's conception is much more plausible as a model both for fictional subjects and for the persona or intentional subject that's heard in the musical work. However, I would actually add, even in the cases in which the Dennettian conception is more plausible, I'd emphasize it can only work because real mental states are, for metaphysical reasons, always states of a subject that can't be reduced to mental events and their relations. This notion of a persona or intentional subject in my discussion so far is more specifically what could be called a minimal persona or a minimal intentional subject. It's to be sharply distinguished from what we could call a program subject, whose states of mind, actions, and even situation are commonly heard in the music only once a verbal program or series of titles is supplied. So the paradigm, a musicologically paradigm case of a program subject, is that of the subject of Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. The states, actions, and even to some extent the situation of the minimal subject can be heard in the music even when there's no verbal program, no titles, no words. And a minimal subject, as I said, can have an extended history over time without being a program subject. The initial state, change, and development of the mental life of the minimal but extensive intentional subject can be heard in a long piece of purely instrumental music without descriptive titles or verbal program. It's plausibly the case for Mahler's own symphonies, very plausibly the case for late Schubert instrumental music. By contrast, without the program given by a text, listeners would be extremely unlikely to hear the last movement of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique as a witch's Sabbath. They would at most hear in the music the effect of scary, grotesque events. Some writers have tried to reach the idea of an intentional subject, even in purely instrumental music that lacks a verbal program, by projection backwards from the case in which there is a verbal program, a program subject. And the idea of extending the kind of subject heard in program music like Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique or The Herald in Italy backwards to purely absolute instrumental music without any associated words, that's very explicit and clear in Edward Cohn's writings and his block lectures that he gave in Berkeley that came to be published as the book The Composer's Voice. I'm about to be critical of Edward Cohn, but the Cohn book is actually, though I disagree with parts of it, really a very, very fine example of quasi-philosophical writing about music. It has a clarity and precision that makes it accessible in ways certain other writings aren't. So Ed Cohn wrote this. He said, "It should be possible, then, to generalize the categories used to analyze Berlioz's approach to program music so as to throw light on all instrumental music." That's the end of the quote. But I do have to dissociate the notion of the minimal intentional subject or persona I've been using from Cohn's particular theoretical characterization of that generalization from the program case. The two crucial notions in his theoretical characterization are that of symbolic utterance and the gestural properties of the utterance. Here's another quote from him. He says, "For any instrumental composition can be interpreted as the symbolic utterance of a virtual persona. This utterance," he goes on, "may be a symbolic play in which a number of virtual agents assume leading roles. It may be a symbolic monologue in which a single agent addresses an audience. It may be a symbolic soliloquy, a private utterance that an audience overhears. But in every case, there is a musical persona that is the experiencing subject of the entire composition, whose inner life the music communicates by means of symbolic gesture." It's the end of the quote. And then in the epilogue of the book, he tries to make things more explicit. I think that was written after the lectures. And Cohn emphasizes the properties of utterances as relevant to music. He writes, I quote, "Like physical gesture, verbal gesture communicates the speaker's or the writer's attitude towards what he's saying, or it tries to influence his hearers or readers, not by the sense of the discourse, but by its intensity. It's the gestural aspect of utterance that is simulated and symbolized by music. The gestures of music can be interpreted as symbolic of physical as well as verbal gestures." That's the end of the quotes. Problem with Cohn's theoretical characterization of these matters, it seems to me to account at most for the agentially expressive. It doesn't explain those features of the intentional subject or persona that depend on the purely expressive. The same range of objections as applied to against Stephen Davis's contour theory apply against Cohn's characterization of the persona or intentional subject in terms of gestural significance. We noted last lecture that you can hear mind wandering, for instance, in Debussy's Reverie. There's no relevant gestural properties associated with mind wandering, not anything that's specific to mind wandering anyway. And the same holds for a huge range of other specific emotions and action modalities that can be heard in the music. Ed Cohn does use, in the passages I just quoted, the notion of the experiencing subject of the entire composition. But I think that the account in terms of expressive gestures can't do justice to the importance of that notion, unless we take into account the extensive role of the purely expressive in determining the properties of the intentional experiencing subject. So let's return to what can be explained once we employ the notion of the minimal intentional subject or persona and continue to focus on the distinction between the purely expressive and the agentially expressive. For example, if a piece of music is initially only purely expressive and then suddenly becomes agentially expressive, there's three possibilities. One is that the affect heard in the expressive action heard in the music is experienced as affect of the same continuing subject as was heard earlier in the music. Second possibility is that it's experienced as a new, different subject of that affect. We then have interpersonal drama in the music. A third possibility is that it's left open in the phenomenology, whether it's the same subject or not. In that case, at least temporarily, we have mystery in the music. The distinction between the purely expressive and the agentially expressive, when combined with the notion of the intentional subject, presents various opportunities for the composer, and it's obvious in the history of music these opportunities have been exploited. It opens up the possibility of great drama even in absolute music, which of course is what you experience in great late string quartets of Beethoven. The expressed world perceived in a piece of music is a way of capturing an important component of its subjective component. I'm not a philosopher who regularly quotes Hegel, but Hegel is really good on this topic. It's in the spirit of some of Hegel's most perceptive remarks. Here's what Hegel wrote. He said, "What alone is fitted for expression in music is the object-free inner life, abstract subjectivity as such." Again, he wrote, this is from the lectures on aesthetics. "Music's purpose must be limited to making the inner life intelligible to itself, whether by making the substantial inner depth of a subject matter as such penetrate the depths of the heart, or whether by preferring to display the life and energy of subject matter in a single subjective inner life, so that this subjective deep feeling itself becomes music's own proper subject matter." That's the end of the quote. The idea of the expressed world perceived in a piece of music bears on several ideas and theses that have been put forward in the perception of music and indeed the perception of other art forms. So the late critic Daniel Albright of Harvard formulates a thesis that he says is a thesis of Lessing. And his thesis is this. He says, "Music can depict action, but has no power to depict the thing that acts. Music is all verb, no noun. By contrast, on the view that makes good use of the idea of the expressed world perceived in a piece of music, the listener can often construct a musical intentional subject or persona, one with a temporal history, whose mental states stand in various causal relations, states that develop over time, that involve one another psychological reactions to events represented as external. So on the conception of the world of the music, there's much to be said about the consciousness of this intentional subject that's heard in the music. It is not all verb, no noun. What is true, however, is that all this is given from the first-person point of view. Depiction, by contrast, does necessarily involve a third-person point of view on its subject matter. And the Lessing-like position that's formulated by Albright is right in that respect. But it's implausible if it's given a formulation that implies that no mental representation of a subject is involved in the appreciation of music. There's a whole psychological subjective history given from the first-person point of view in a whole series of great works we could list. The types of emotion and affect and action modality within this expressed world perceived are all states of a type that can be experienced in real life outside music. In real life, the very same types are experienced, not as metaphorical content or as merely similar to real expressive action, but as the real states themselves. I call this the principle of independent possibility. Principle of independent possibility states that the emotion or modality of action or expressive action type heard in the music is always something that can occur in real life outside music. And this principle of independent possibility is very clearly implied, indeed effectively stated, I think, in another of Hegel's observations. He says, this subjective feeling, namely, may accompany every human deed and action, every expression of the inner life, and it may be aroused even by the perception of every action and the apprehension of any occurrence. And this feature of music is equally entirely able to organize. That's the end of the quote. So if the principle of independent possibility is correct, it ought to make one very skeptical of the idea of a specifically musical emotion. Any emotion heard in the music is an emotion that can, in principle, be experienced in non-musical events. Same applies to modalities of action heard in the music. Sometimes writers use the phrase musical emotion to mean simply emotion heard in the music. That's just potentially misleading. It's not in conflict with the principle of independent possibility. But if more than that is meant, the idea of a specifically musical emotion would somehow involve a conception of an emotion or action modality that couldn't be experienced in any other way. It would be incompatible with the principle of independent possibility. And it raised the question why we should even be interested in the expression of the alleged purely musical emotions. They'd be utterly disconnected with our actual emotional lives. There's also a close connection between the notion of the expressed world perceived in a piece of music and the principle of musical acquaintance I talked about in the preceding lecture. Formulated in a relatively neutral way, neutral as between competing philosophical theories of content, the principle of musical acquaintance stated that any property we hear in the music is a property with which we are acquainted. So the expressed world perceived in a musical work is a structured sequence of psychological states, events, action modalities given from the first-person point of view, and the principle of musical acquaintance is thereby implied for everything in the expressed world perceived. In short, it's a necessary condition for hearing the subjective character of a life or part of a life in the music. The properties heard in the music are ones with which the hearer is acquainted. Otherwise, the music wouldn't, in being heard, convey the subjective character of a life. I'll skip that paragraph. At the level of mental representations underlying our perception of music, the phenomenon of our hearing intentional subjects in the music seems to me to be promising territory for further application of the notion of a mental file that Professor Recanati has used so much. There have been plausible uses of the notion in the case of object files, of self files, present tense files, files labeled with proper names, or other linguistic expressions. This current discussion suggests that there's a kind of mental file underlying our perception of intentional subjects in music, a file that's gradually filled with further representations of mental states and action modalities, given under Jacksonian modes of presentation, and adjusted for the passing of time as the music proceeds. You need a dynamic conception. The ability of a listener to appreciate longer reaches of the intentional subject back to earlier movements of a work, the ability to appreciate certain mental states represented in the file as reactions to earlier events heard as external, as reactions to the subject's own previous mental states. All of that, of course, is dependent very plausibly upon the listener's ability to build up a mental file on the intentional subject. In the introduction to the first of these lectures, I touted as one of the advantages of the categories and philosophical theses that I've been offering that they can be used to articulate distinctions in music theory and musicology that are otherwise a little hard to explain. And by way of not leaving this claim entirely unsubstantiated, I propose that we can use the preceding distinctions I've outlined so far to advance our characterization and understanding of the musical movement, possibly other movements too, of expressionism in musical composition in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Expressionist music, as exemplified in pre-serial Arnold Schoenberg or in Strauss's opera Elektra or Salome, it's obviously not uniquely distinguished by the fact that we hear expressive action in the music, expressive action in lots of other music, nor is it uniquely characterized by the fact it's expressive of particularly intense or extreme emotions or action modalities. There's lots of expression of intense or extreme emotions and action modalities, for example, in English Elizabethan song, like take Thomas Campion's Miserere, My Maker, and it's also true of some passages in Mozart, particularly his works in G minor. Sometimes people have tried to characterize expressionism as distinctively exhibiting the fact that it, quote, tries to depict not the objective facts of nature, but the subjective feelings of the artist, end of quote. That's a proposal put forward by the Crawfords in a book on expressionism. But again, the same objection arises. That can be at most necessary condition for music to be expressionist, not sufficient. The more serene parts of Haydn's Seven Last Words on the Cross depict, if we're going to use the word depict, subjective feelings rather than objective facts of nature. And I doubt anyone would regard these serene passages of Haydn as early examples of expressionism. Nor is the characterization of expressionism adequately refined by saying that the musical means of conveying the intense or extreme psychological states are themselves extreme means, large jumps in pitch, irregular rhythmic structures, sudden changes of pace. One can imagine various entertaining, joyous pieces of music with those features that are not expressionistic, nor need they be parodies of expressionism either. I think that in characterizing and understanding expressionism, we need rather to look at the artistic and aesthetic purposes and the conditions of success behind such extreme means of expression when they really are examples of expressionism. It seems to me that what's essential to expressionism is that we hear a greatly disturbed mind in the music. That's part of the aesthetic and artistic purpose served by the means of expression in expressionism. That much is hardly news. What the preceding philosophical discussions and theses allow us to do is to characterize more precisely how successful expressionist music allows us to hear the disturbed mind in the music. If hearing action expressed in the music is experiencing features of the music as similar to non-musical expressive action, then hearing the music as an expression of a disturbed mind is hearing features of the music as similar, subjectively similar, to the expressive actions of a disturbed person. And that seems to be a plausible description of how we hear expressionist music. Corresponding points apply to what's purely expressed in expressionist music as well. I think the apparatus of the expressed world perceived also assists in articulating the nature of expressionist music. The subjective world, the expressed world perceived in expressionist music, is itself that of an unstable mind, not just with extreme affective attitudes and action modalities, but with sudden changes and variations quite different from those of the stable, normal mind. The expressed world perceived in expressionist music is always close to, at, or across the verge of being that of a disintegrating subject at the level of consciousness. And the subjective world, for example, in Schoenberg's monodrama Erwartung, that would be a paradigm case in which disintegration is occurring. I mentioned earlier as one characteristic of expressive action in general, I mentioned in the first lecture, that although it's not a product of means-end reasoning, expressive action may nevertheless have properties that are intentional on the part of the agent. Someone in pain may say out loud, not in communication to anyone else, but simply as an expressive act, "It hurts so much," with a specific and intentional intonation contour in saying so. Expressionist composers, when composing passages in which expressive action is heard, frequently exploit our capacity to experience the music as similar to the intentional features of those kinds of expressive utterances. Strauss's characters in Elektra and Salome do that all the time. Once we acknowledge that expressive action isn't produced by means-end reasoning, there's a clear sense in which when we perceive expressive action as such, what we perceive is more directly revealing of the psychology of the agent than is non-expressive action. That was exactly the point Wagner was making in the passages I quoted in Lecture 1. If a composer, or more generally, a creator of an artistic work, has a certain conception of what that psychology of the represented subject contains or involves, expressive action can be marshaled to show what that psychology contains or to manifest its features. So, with that characterization of expressive action, its role in perception of music, it should come as no surprise that Schoenberg would write, as he did, "One must express oneself directly, not one's taste or upbringing or one's intelligence or knowledge or skill, not all these acquired characteristics, but that which is inborn, instinctive." That's the end of the quote. As that quotation from Schoenberg illustrates, expressionism was not only a movement of artistic style, but its practitioners expounded doctrines about the processes of composing, and indeed painting too. Here there's a danger of a non sequitur. From the fact that it's valuable to compose and paint in ways that are expressive of a disturbed mind, where the expression of the represented agent doesn't involve means-end reasoning, it hardly follows that composing or painting by engaging in expressive action without means-end reasoning is a good idea. But without ourselves making such an illegitimate transition, we can see why attempts to reject conventional means of expression and the idea that expressive action is revelatory of the unconscious would be attractive to the expressionist frame of mind once we understand the distinctive character of expressive action. And it'd be possible to expound these points at length, both applied to the music and to the art and the literature of expressionism, and indeed to the writings of expressionist composers, artists, and writers about their own creations. Okay, now I want to turn to a psychological topic that's closely connected with the idea of the intentional subject heard in the music. It's a fact of everyday musical experience that seeing the performer enhances the experience of the music, and in particular enhances the experience of its emotional content and the action modalities heard in the music. There's the famous semi-dramatization by Peter Sellers of Bach's Matthew Passion that was done at the Philharmonie in Berlin about 10 years ago with Simon Rattle. If you just hear the music, it's a powerful experience when heard simply on a stereo system. When you actually see it on the video, on the DVD, the effect is overwhelming. And dramatization of the work is not necessary for additional effect. Let me just first play you an audio file without you seeing the performer and then doing it with seeing the performer. So here is this is the aria at the end of Handel's The Triumph of Truth and Disillusion. So, and this is sung by Julia Lesneva, the Russian soprano. And now we'll see it with the video. Here I need to use I think I just plug this in here. And this is exactly the same performance, but now with the video. I hope we'll play it. Let's see. Oh, God, yeah. So, extraordinary enhancement of the total experience. If we'd had more time, we could also talk about the joint perception of joint coordinated action there, which is also very striking in the perception of the orchestral performers. The phenomenon seems real. It seems to enhance your musical experience enormously to be able to see the performer. There's a question. How can vision add anything, given what's supposed to be an auditory musical experience? Well, this how is it possible question needs answers of at least two different kinds. We need an answer to the question of how it's possible as a matter of empirical psychology. There must be some connection between the visual experience and the experience of the music. We also need an answer at the constitutive philosophical level. How are we to characterize the phenomenology of the experience if, again, music seems to be a matter just of what's heard in the music? That's equally a puzzle. And the answer to these two how questions must properly dovetail with one another. On the question of the empirical psychological explanation of the phenomenon, I suggest that what we have here is essentially what we can categorize very briefly as an emotional McGurk effect. McGurk famously discovered that if an audiophile plays the syllable ba out loud, while the subject listening to that audio also sees on a screen the lips of a speaker making the sound ga, that what we get is a compromise between the two. The listener perceives da, which is halfway between ba and ga. A purely visual experience influences what is heard. And I suggest that there's no difficulty in principle in the same happening for the emotional and action modality content of music. Seeing an action expressive of some emotional action modality can causally influence the intensity or even the kind of emotional action modality heard in the music. The power of vision to capture the experience is well known from other cases. The phenomenon of visual capture is very well known in psychology of spatial perception. This is just another illustration of that power. Here, the influence of vision is not just on how an auditory state represents the world, but on what features of the music in it are heard metaphorically as or similar to. But there's nothing in principle impossible about the state of affairs. As for the answer to the question, the philosophical how question, I suggest that certain features of the music are not merely heard metaphorically as certain emotions and action modalities, but are heard also as those expressed in the action of the performer as seen. They're heard as those expressed in the actions of the performer as seen. Similarly, certain features of the music are heard as similar, not just to certain expressive actions considered in the abstract, but as similar to those seen in the actions of the performer. If listeners to a piece of music do construct a mental file underlying the attribution of properties to the intentional subject heard in the music, then the mechanism involved in visual enhancement of music performance is relatively straightforward. The extra expressive properties seen in the actions of the performer are attributed to the intentional subject by insertion of representations of those fine-grained properties into the corresponding mental file on the intentional subject. This, incidentally, is analogous to what an audience member in the theatre does in transferring expressive properties of the actions of the real actor to the character Hamlet, or whoever the actor is performing. In both the psychological and the philosophical answers to the how question, it's crucial that in seeing someone perform an expressive action, one can see in that action expression of some specific emotion or action modality. It's also important for both explanations that the way in which the emotion or action modality is given in such perception is a way that's made available by one's acquaintance with the emotion or action modality. Without those points, there'd be a gap in the explanation. There'd be a difference between the way the emotion or action modality is given in the perception of the action of the musical performer and the way in which it's given when one hears features of the music metaphorically as some mental state. But in fact, there is no such gap. Finally, on the notion of agency, let me discuss a further level of fineness of grain of what's heard in the music. It's implicit in what I've said so far, but let me try and make it a little bit more explicit. I emphasized in the first lecture that the emotional content and content concerning action modalities of a piece of music that sets a text is more fine-grained than is given by the meaning of the text itself. The agency of the performer of a piece of music on a particular occasion should make us acknowledge a further layer of fine-grained emotion and actional content. When Billie Holiday sings Strange Fruit, or practically anything else for that matter, what we hear in the music and singing is different and distinctive from the way in which others sing it. A very striking case is given by another famous civil rights performer, Nina Simone. Nina Simone sang early on in her career the famous song anthem, in effect, "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free." Nina Simone sings that song in different ways at different times in her life. And we haven't really got time now, but if you have a chance on music.youtube.com to see the way she sings it, in 1976 at the Montreux Jazz Festival, it comes over as a deeply personal song about her own life. There's anger in the music. It's intensely inward-looking in a way that, considered as a personal, as a political anthem that would be sung at rallies of Martin Luther King, is utterly different. This is a level of fine-grained content that's given not by the music and the text, but something else additional, the way it's performed, or in this case, sung, by the particular performer. The extra fine-grained content in different performances of a given text and score, setting it to music, matters to us. It's obviously caused by differences in micro-timings, in timbre, and relations between these, much else. The physical causal basis for what makes a performance distinctive, of course, doesn't need to be known to the audience for them to appreciate it. And the additional source of fine-grained content, of course, exists for purely instrumental music as well as vocal music. And to deny that is absurd, really. Once we acknowledge this additional source of fine-grained content, there's a further significance in being able to see the performer perform. Some of the performer's actions may be expressive of this further fine-grained layer of content that goes beyond what's determined by the musical score. By the emotional McGurk effect, they can contribute literally to how the music is heard. Stravinsky wrote, it's a bit strange quoting Stravinsky because he said different things at different times in his life and often said whatever suited the most recent work he wrote, but he did say this. He wrote in his Poetics of Music lectures he gave, he said, "An experienced eye follows and judges, sometimes unconsciously, the performer's least gesture. From this point of view, one might conceive the process of performance as the creation of new values." That's it. The experienced eye, he said, follows and judges. The new values created include the further determination of fine-grained content made available to the perceiver, not merely by hearing, but also by seeing the performer. There were extensive discussions in the 19th century, and continued by the extreme views of Glenn Gould in the 20th century, about the desirability or undesirability of seeing the musical performer. And someone so inclined could trace these discussions and the theses to which the various parties were committed in relation to the distinction I've been offering here. Here I return again to the significance of the Jacksonian modes of presentation under which the mental states are given in the music. To repeat, they involve this acquaintance relation. When a musical performer is successful, as I said, the same Jacksonian mode of presentation of a fine-grained conscious state enters all of the following four. It enters the performer's intention in action in playing the music in a certain way, that a certain fine-grained state be heard in the music. It enters what the performer hears in the music as played when the performance is successful. It enters what the listener hears in the music. And that last, it can be partially determined by the listener's visual perception of the performer. Not merely is it the case that the same fine-grained content is communicated and appreciated, in the most successful musical events, there's joint awareness over an extended period by the performers and audiences that that's so. An audience's reaction to a continuing performance, the performer's appreciation of that reaction, can help to make this continue to be the case. That's all part of the multifaceted value of live performance. So all these points add further to the significance of agency for the perception of music. The phenomenon of visual enhancement of musical experience and the philosophical characterization of what it involves in the consciousness of the listener would all be impossible if all that mattered in the perception of music were pitch, volume, and timbre of the sounds produced, as on the acousmatic conception defended by Scruton. What also matters and makes possible multiple features of the phenomenology of music is that musical performances or actions are perceived as such. The agency, I think, is a crucial part of musical communication. Okay, it's getting late, so to summarize, I've put various pieces, in effect, on the board for philosophical and phenomenological discussion of music. The various kinds of emotional content that can occur in the music, the purely expressive, the agentially expressive, the reactive. I've talked about how those emotions and mental states are given in the music. I've talked about how they can generate an intentional subject to the music. I've talked about the aesthetic significance of all of these. There is a huge agenda at this point because we can obviously invoke all of these notions in characterizing various kinds of music, musical styles, distinctions that are drawn by musicologists. I think there's some good work in that direction. But there's also a very important interdisciplinary project here. There are enormous questions about how, for example, is the isomorphism between features of the music and features of the mental states it expresses. How is that subpersonally mentally represented? What's the role of magnitudes in the representation? We obviously you don't need to know consciously that isomorphism. It somehow underlies your experience, your phenomenology exploits it, but it must be mentally realized, it must be psychologically real in some way. What is it for it to be psychologically real? Important, interesting question, both empirical and conceptual. There are other questions too about particular particular kinds of perceivers who enjoy music. For example, it's very striking that subjects who are on the autistic spectrum disorder have somewhere on that spectrum often have an intense appreciation of music, despite the fact that they're very weak, very poor at ascribing psychological states to others. So what is it specially about the content of music that makes this emotionally available to them when the emotional states of others are not available to them? Obviously, it's got something, I think, to do with the first personal character, the way in which the states are given in the emotional content of music. And there's a lot more to be said about that, too. I think once you begin to think about this territory, you begin to think about metaphor and representation of metaphor in very, very different ways from it's given in some of the psychological and philosophical literature. That's all further downstream. All I want to convince you of by the end of the second literature is that these distinctions that I've been introducing may help us move these things forward a little bit. Thanks very much.